writer on YU Torah. I've been told they're available through Facebook as well. I'm not sure how to access that, or through the shul's page. Hopefully, you won't have a difficult time finding past recordings, as well as the slideshows as well. It looks like most people who are here are here tonight. We were here last week. The first three slides of tonight are just to recap not everything that we did last week, but sort of the main idea, which I think will help us segue into tonight's presentation, which is entitled, "To the Dust You Shall Return," which of course is a quote from the Pasuk, "Ve'ela Ofer Tashuv," before, during, and after the funeral. Last week, we pointed out that if you look in the Torah, in Tanakh in general, and through the words of Chazal, we find that death is described as something which is much more peaceful, much more transcendent, much less frightening than the way we often relate to death when we speak about it, either in a completely secular sense, or even because we're just not sufficiently informed, inspired, and enlightened as to how the Torah describes and depicts death. Some of the words that the Torah uses to describe death are really very different than the words that we would use to describe. V'atatavo elavatecha, v'yeyaseif elamav, v'shachavti imavasai, v'inei anochi holeif, p'tira yitzi menucha. Again, we're not going to recap everything we said, but these words certainly have a very, very different connotation, a very different implication, and leave us with a real challenge, namely to try to process and to relate to death in general, and when the time comes that we are trying to assist those in our life who are making this transition, to be able to process it and to experience on a completely different level. We mentioned that the Gemara in Brachos Daf Yud, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, tells us that a person should be able to sing Shira at all the different steps and milestones in life. And one of the stages in which a soul should sing, should rejoice, is B'yom HaMisa, as Rabbi Yochanan teaches, as you see underlined, is Tachil B'yom HaMisa V'Amar Shira, that the soul should be able to say Shira B'yom HaMisa. The Gemara in Mo'en Katan tells us that when we go to a Levaya and we are either inspired to cry, we feel a sense to cry, we should, but understanding that our tears are really for the loss that we feel, for the void that we now feel in our lives, but not for the nifter, not for the deceased. Because our belief is that the neshama is now at rest, has now gone to a, as we say, a better place, and we are left feeling bereft. And finally, the Mishnah Avos in the fourth chapter, which tells us Hayilodim Lamus VaHamesim LaHichayos, which gives us a completely different perspective on death. Death is not necessarily an end, but just like the living are destined to die, the dead are destined to live. As we mentioned last week, Hashem is Memis Umechaya. And finally, the last slide from last week, the Sefer Gesher HaChaim, which is the title of the Sefer, captures a very, very important, not just an imagery, but a message that the author, Rav Tukhachinsky Zatzal, tried to convey, and that is that we should view life as being a bridge, as Chazal has told us, the prozdor, the gateway, before we enter the ulam, the main, the ballroom, if you will. And he uses a very, very powerful mashal, which is really based on a medrash, a mashal which describes a conversation between two babies in a womb, and they are, one is sort of the optimist and one is the pessimist. One is describing life in this world as being seemingly very gloomy and lonely, and it's just the two of us. And the other one says, no, you have to have faith that there's more beyond. And they go back and forth until finally the optimist is born first, and the pessimist is left feeling like he's all alone forever and ever. And the optimist is saying, no, you don't understand, soon you're going to be here with me in this better world. And this is, of course, a very powerful mashal, which we can use to, again, to help us process death in a more healthy perspective, in a way that will give us chizik when we are dealing with some of these challenges in life. Now, tonight's topic is, as I mentioned beforehand, before, during, and after the funeral. At the time of death, when a person who is halachically required to experience a period known as avelos, so we're talking about one of the seven relatives, a person loses a mother or father, a brother or sister, a son or a daughter or a spouse, So in any one of those situations, a person is halachically going to experience avelus. The initial period is known as aninus. Aninus. And what the Mishnah Brachos tells us in the very beginning of Mishnah Brachos is that Misha Meso Mutalafano, literally a person who's has a relative who's Mutalafano, who's placed before him, literally or figuratively, Patur Mikriya Shema Minatfilin. So the Mishnah tells us that such an individual is exempt from having to carry out some very, very basic religious responsibilities and obligations, such as saying Shema, Shlein Tfilin, and other mitzvahs as well. This is the concept known as aninus. Really, in a most technical sense, there is a difference between an onen and misha meisa mutalafanav. For our presentation this night, tonight, we're not going to make such a distinction. We usually use those two terms synonymously. Now, the Pnei Moshe is a commentary, and the Gemara Yishalmi tells us that there are two reasons as to why misha meisa mutalafanav, a person who is an onen, is patur from mitzvahs. Number one, he says, "Mipnei kvodo shemeis." Number one, it could be a demonstration of honor to the deceased. Shemara atmo she'enu chashav ve'enu lisabel olav. Because perhaps if a person remains preoccupied in other obligations, even religious ones, it may perhaps distract the person from the honor that is due to the meis at this time. And therefore, in an effort to promote kavanah meis, Chazal have completely excused or relieved the person of other obligations. The other possibility, he says, is O mishum shetzarehu she'en lo mishayisa maso l'satek b'kfur aso. The other possibility is that a person, naturally at such a time, is very preoccupied, not only emotionally, but with the very pressing and timely mitzvah of seeing to it that this individual is able to have a proper kfura in the proper time. And so therefore, I am literally osek in a mitzvah this time, and therefore I can't become distracted and have to deal with other obligations. Ironically, there are times, I've heard this many, many times, it's understandable, where people fight me a little bit, and they say, really, I can't say a bracha? I can't daven, but I have to. So it's ironic, in a sense, that we're telling a person who feels obviously preoccupied with the matter at hand, but at the same time, feels that it's almost like the aninus itself becomes a distraction, but understand and appreciate that this is what's going on over here. Rav Soloveitchik, in an essay, which has been republished in several places, one of them is Out of the Whirlwind, which is a book which the shul actually has a copy upstairs, essays on mourning, suffering, and human condition. So the Rav has, I believe it's the first or second chapter in this book, he has a chapter entitled Aninus and Avelus, and he tries to differentiate between the two, and I have several quotes in the beginning at the end of tonight's presentation from the Rav. The Rav will capture, you know, sort of the philosophical of message and underpinnings of Aninus in a way that I could never properly explain on my own. This is a quote. Aninus represents the spontaneous human reaction to death. It is an outcry, a shout, or a howl of grisly horror and disgust. Man responds to his defeat at the hands of death with total resignation and with an all-consuming, masochistic, self-devastating, black despair. Beaten by the friend, his prayers rejected, enveloped by a hideous darkness, forsaken and lonely, man begins to question his own human singular reality. Doubt develops quickly into a cruel conviction, and doubting man turns into mocking man. He tells himself, if death is the final destiny of all men, if everything human terminates in the narrow, dark grave, then why be a man at all? Then why make the pretense of being the choicest of all creatures? Then why lay claim to singularity and imago Dei? Then why be committed? Why carry the human moral load? Are we not, the mourner continues to question himself, just a band of conceited and inflated daydreamers who somehow manage to convince themselves of some imaginary superiority over the brutes in the jungle? The halacha has displayed great compassion with perplexed man, suffering man firmly held in the clutches of his archenemy death. The halacha has never tried to gloss over the sorrowful, ugly spectacle of dying man. In spite of the fact that the halacha has indomitable faith in eternal life, in immortality, and in the continued transcendental existence for all human beings, it did understand, like a loving, sympathetic mother, man's fright and confusion when confronted with death. Therefore, the halacha has tolerated those crazy, torturing thoughts and doubts. It did not command the mourner to own them because they contradict the basic halachic doctrine of man's election as the king of the universe. that permitted the mourner to have his way for a while and has ruled that the latter be relieved of all mitzvos. And finally, says the Rav, how can man pray and address himself to God if he doubts his very humanity, if speech is stripped of it by his doubts of his human characteristics and turns into mere physical sound? How can the mourner pronounce a benediction or say amen if he is speechless? He is still capable of producing sounds, but a benediction consists of spiritual words and not of just physical sounds. I don't expect anybody here to have been able to fully process that as quickly as I read it, but I hope you agree with me that it's kedai to at least experience it initially in all of its beauty, and then I told you where you could find it, you could read it again and absorb it and take it in. But the Rav so beautifully captures what Aninus is all about, namely the halacha's recognition that initially, when man first faces death, there's a certain shock that needs to be absorbed. And rather than force an individual at such a time, that time, to open his siddur and to put on his tefillin and to go back to the books, the halacha accommodates man's need at such a time to experience the horror of death for what it is. Now, of course, there are technical laws of aninus which I'd like to review. Anything that we talk about tonight in terms of the laws of aninus, of the burial, of everything we're going to discuss, it should be stated from the outset, is not meant to be completely comprehensive. I did try to get in as many of the fine points as possible, but of course, for every rule, there are exceptions, and I didn't necessarily mention all the exceptions over here. So of course, this should be helpful for just a basic understanding, but of course, please understand that this is not meant to be completely exhaustive. So number one, as was mentioned already, an onen is going to be exempt from mitzvah saseh, but must still adhere to mitzvah lo saseh. So that means that all of the prohibitions in the Torah still apply. Examples include davening and recitation of brachos, even to recite amen when hearing a bracha. That is something that an onen does not do. Although technically this is only an exemption, it is treated as if it is mandatory, which means we do not make it optional. Now there may be situations where a person is, let's say, completely in a different city and unable in any way whatsoever to preoccupy him or herself with matters relating to the Torah. In that situation, a person may actually not be exempt from mitzvos. But generally, an onen is not just exempt from mitzvos, but basically we tell a person, you are relieved and should not attempt to do mitzvos in the situation. There are exceptions. Washing before bread. If a person is having bread, they would wash their hands without a bracha. A person who is an onen could still wear tzitzis. And I mentioned Sfiras Omer in quotations. With a question mark. There's an interesting debate brought down in the Bir Halacha as to whether or not a person who's in an onen would still count Sfiras without a bracha, and especially if there'll be more than a 24-hour break before the kvura, what would that mean in terms of that individual being able to continue the count thereafter? So it's for the purpose of this discussion, it's not settled. So I leave it over there with a question mark. There's a prohibition of eating meat or poultry or wine until after the funeral. During the shiv itself, there are no dietary restrictions, but during this period of aninus, an onen is not supposed to eat meat, poultry, or wine. Restrictions of avelus apply, such as bathing, haircut, but not the nihuge avelus, meaning things like sitting on the floor and removal of leather shoes. The outward observances that are unique to avelus don't apply, but the restrictions, the prohibitions of avelus, and this is not meant to be an exhaustive list either, so those do apply even at the period of aninus. Talmud Torah, the study of Torah is already prohibited. It is prohibited to recite the Tehillim, therefore, for that very reason. This is not done when a person is an onen. Preparation for eulogies are permitted, even if that means the person is going to open a sefer. Okay. Prohibition of personal business activities. There are times before a person is observing shiva where they need to contact the office and make arrangements so that people know what to do and who to contact in one's absence. That's absolutely fine. But to go ahead and continue in the course of one's normal business while waiting for funeral arrangements to be finalized is not proper, just as one would not do so during the period of avelus. Finally, as far as the laws of aninus, there's no aninus on Shabbos and Yom Tov, with the exception of private restrictions of avelus. So a person who's an onaid, let's say sometimes happens, a person dies after Shabbos, and the funeral is not till Sunday, so on Shabbos they're going to go to shul, and they're going to daven, and they can even eat meat and wine, etc., but the private restrictions of avelus apply even to an onen in this situation. There is a concept known as halonas hames, which means allowing a mes, a deceased person, to remain unburied over the course of an entire night. This concept of Alanas Ameis comes remarkably from a parsha in the Torah. As you see over here, I quoted two pesukim from Parshas Ki Tesi, which talk about an individual who has been executed by Beis Din, an individual who committed some horrific offense, that they were actually convicted of a capital crime and executed. And even this individual, who you would think maybe because of how evil and how wicked such an individual was, we wouldn't really care so much for the kavod, the honor that is due to this individual, the Torah says that such an individual must be buried immediately. And so therefore, every effort should be made to proceed with burial as soon as possible. In the absence of any unique extenuating considerations, which are determined by halacha, obviously, it is prohibited to delay the burial from one day to the next. Now, there are situations which come up. One of them is a very common scenario. If the family wishes to delay the funeral to allow for a close relative or relatives to attend, in this case, halachic guidance should be sought. What it all comes down to in these cases, for the most part, is what's called kavod ames. So if there are considerations which present themselves, which would indicate that delaying, postponing the funeral for a certain given period of time would actually allow for greater honor to the deceased, either because there will be more people who will be able to attend the funeral will be able to take place in a coveted place, or a certain very close relative would be able to be there. So this is all factored into the equation, because after all, the prohibition over here is all about trying to honor the mace appropriately. But all things being equal, we proceed as soon as possible. There's an interesting discussion among the poskim as to whether or not you are required to expedite the process even on that very day, meaning if a funeral home gives you a choice, we could do a levaya at 9 o'clock, at 11 o'clock, at 2 o'clock. So that's not necessarily required as far as... it's certainly not a prohibition of halonis, at least in the most technical sense. This is a concept of zrizin mekdimin lemitzvos, but over there, one could certainly be practical and think about what makes most sense at that particular time. But the real question over here is, under what circumstances is it permissible to actually delay the burial by an entire day? Of course, here in the United States, it's very uncommon to hear burials that are done at night. There are certain cemeteries that will accommodate that. It's not against the law. It's just most cemeteries close at night. In Israel, on the other hand, it's very common for there to be burials at night. So the problem of halonas ames, so the need to actually go ahead and wait till the next day, is actually heard of much less in Israel than it is here. Now, after a person passes away, before we proceed with the burial, there is a process known as tahara, taharas ames, which is probably best translated as the purification of the body. This is performed by a chevra kadisha, a specially trained and skilled group of individuals who conduct themselves with modesty, meaning they don't walk around with t-shirts that say, I'm part of the local chevra kadisha. A person who works on the chevra is never going to come over to somebody in shul the next day and say, I just want you to know that I participate in the tahara for so-and-so. You would never, ever hear that, nor should you. That's what it means that they are modest. And the process is one which is very dignified. Kimuvan, that is carried out in a way which demonstrates dignity to the body. And even though the body is, at this point, a former receptacle to a soul, it's no longer containing the soul, but the body has kedusha that continues, just like, actually Chazal used this very mashal, just like a sefer Torah, tefillin, mezuzah, when it is no longer fit for use, becomes a puzzle, it still has to be treated with respect. It's called Tashmisha Kedusha. So a body is really the same way. Ideally, the tahara is done as close to the kruah as possible. I say ideally because sometimes there are other practical considerations which would require the Chevra Kedusha to schedule earlier. But ideally, we do it as close to the funeral as possible. There are three main components to the tahara. We're not going to spend much time on the tahara tonight, just to understand very briefly what it is. Number one, rechitza, which is washing the body, cleaning the body, making sure that that chatzitzos are removed, that the body should be clean. Then there is tahara, ritual purification, which also involves the use of water, but in a more ritual sense, rather than merely for the purpose of cleansing. And finally, habash of dressing the nifter in special tachrichim and burial shrouds. These are all part of the responsibilities of the Chevra Kadisha. And finally, placed in a simple, plain aron. I place this in parentheses because over here again, in America, it is, I think, required by law that a person be buried in an aron, in a box, but in Eretz Yisrael, people are placed directly in the ground. And so therefore, placing a person in an aron is not a required responsibility of the Chevra Kadisha, but, you know, depending on where they are, this is something that's done. But we have a tradition dating all the way back to the Tanoim of using simple tachrichim, burial shrouds, the same type of simple plain pine box for everybody, that we try not to do anything fancy. Funeral homes sometimes they'll present you with, well, we have this, we have that, we have that. But our tradition is to, you know, always use things that are most simple. There are many other customs and rituals throughout this process. This certainly was not meant to be exhaustive in any way, but just gives some sort of insight as to what happens at a tahara. As far as the preparation for the funeral, for the individuals themselves who are experiencing this, so number one, on a very practical note, discuss all details with the funeral director before the funeral. All expectations, intentions, wishes, and related details should be clearly spelled out and agreed upon in advance. Now, I have to say, even though, you know, this is not a discussion, this is not a forum to have discussions about one funeral home over the other, but I will say that the local funeral home that we work with over here, Gutterman's, have been, you know, really very professional in the way that they deal with individuals, in my experience, and are not looking to pull a fast one by anyone. That being said, it's kedai before you sit down, before you finalize them, just sit down and look over and make sure that you know what you're getting in advance. But they don't position themselves with members of our community in a way where, you know, they'll tack on all these expenses that you didn't know about, and, you know, they'll throw in an extra two limos, even though you only have one person going to the cemetery. Unfortunately, there are funeral homes out there that may try to do that, but our local funeral home we have a very good relationship with. I'll mention as well, even though, just to speak to this point, they'll offer this. They'll ask you, even if you don't mention it, but people who are affiliated with RCBC Shuls have a special adjusted rate. Several years ago, you know, the Orthodox community reached out to them and said, listen, there's competition, there are other options, and so they really did try to work out sort of a package because many people in the Orthodox community don't request or don't need some of the extra trimmings and frills that others offer. Yes?
What if the mace, while they were alive, they wrote in their will or they told their children, I want this and this for my funeral, or I want this.
Right. So if the deceased has issued any specific request or has made any prearrangements, the officiating rabbi should be informed as soon as possible. So, then, of course, there are some times that there are requests. Again, now's not the time, but I can tell you some very interesting stories about very, very specific requests that people have made, either years before their passing or more often than not, sometimes weeks, days, or hours before their passing as to what they want, they don't want, and those wishes, for the most part, should be honored. We would go out of our way to accommodate them unless the wishes themselves conflicted with halacha, which is unusual in my experience, but we would definitely want to know that, again, beforehand. There shouldn't be any surprises. I've actually witnessed it's not a comfortable situation to be in where children are arguing about what the father says he wants to be buried in the cemetery, he wasn't buried in the cemetery, I'm telling you, he told me. So these situations obviously are uncomfortable, and it, to the extent that the person has wishes and desires, that's also not the discussion for this evening, but they should be very clearly communicated to members of the family beforehand. Attire. Forgive me, you know, we're talking about a funeral and we're talking about what type of attire to wear, but it's an important point. I've seen individuals who feel that, well, listen, it's a relative's funeral, I should get really dressed up in my finest suit, and then they have to sit in a suit that they may not be so comfortable in for the next week, with the exception of Shabbos, and other wears the same clothes during Shiva. So it's important to be practical about this and thoughtful about what would be comfortable for me for the next week, not necessarily thinking about the particular color of the suit that I'm going to wear. Who should attend the funeral? Children. Again, we're not discussing the details of this right now, but this is an important question. I have my feelings on it. Again, now's not the time to go through all of my feelings about it, but it certainly obviously depends on the child, on the age of the child. There's a difference between attending a chapel service and going to a cemetery. Generally speaking, it is not appropriate to bring a 6 or 7 year old to a cemetery. That may be traumatic for a child. At the same time, you know, children who are even just a few years older than that, you know, can probably handle it. And if they're inclined to, if they want to participate, should be given that opportunity. Obviously, if we're talking about a family member, even a grandparent, it could actually help children experience and process the entire experience of death in a much more healthy way. Again, not a discussion for now, but just as a general statement regarding talking to children about death, there are different ways to explain the process of death to children. We don't necessarily have to share it in all of its gory detail. That being said, everything that's said to a child should be truthful. We shouldn't say things that aren't true, like a person is sleeping, which is sometimes parents say that to their very young children, thinking that that would, you know, that's a good way to sort of, you know, buffer it and help them absorb the shock of it. What am I going to tell them? So sleeping, it sounds very, it sounds like a very, very benign thing to say to a child, but it actually creates a lot of confusion and can actually lead to bigger problems, because every time somebody in the family wants to go to sleep, the child panics, I'm never going to see them again. So you have to be very thoughtful and careful about what you do say and don't say to a child, but as a general rule, you should tell them the truth in a way that they can handle it, and we should remind ourselves that children are actually much better equipped to deal with death than adults are, for the most part. They can handle much more than we can. They're much more resilient than we are, and we shouldn't be so afraid about having to share, again, in a way that they can hear what's going on. Yes?
I have a very serious question, Rabbi. My husband and I have graves in Eretz HaChayim in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say that our body is going to go directly into the ground? I mean, we have a coffin, don't we? A box? We go directly into the ground?
Right, so maybe we'll just, if you don't mind, I'll discuss it with you privately afterwards. In Israel, just very briefly, they have, it's sort of like a, it's not like it is here, where they dig 6-8 feet into the ground and cover it with dirt. They have these casings, it's almost like little tombs that are built into the ground. So it's almost like a person is placed in the box, but actually, the process is different there than it is here. But that's something, let's discuss afterwards if that's okay. I'm happy to answer any questions and give you a better idea of what goes on there. Also, pregnant wife of a Kohen. Again, it's not a very common situation, but then again, it does come up from time to time. A woman who's married to a Kohen and pregnant and maybe carrying a son, so that we do have a tradition that such a woman should not go to a cemetery. She should not come in contact with a mace, because if she's holding, she's carrying a boy, so even though he's not yet obligated in mitzvos, he should not be exposed to tumah even at that stage. On the other hand, other pregnant women, there's an ideal pi kabbalah. There are some people who have certain, I don't say superstitions necessarily, it's not superstitious, but they have certain concerns, mystical concerns about a pregnant woman going to a cemetery. What I tell people when they ask me is that if they're not concerned, if they're comfortable going and they want to, if it's a close relative, even a distant relative, a close friend, that they can go to a funeral, they can go to a cemetery, but she has to be comfortable with it. She has to be right. But technically, Mikra Adin, there's nothing wrong with a pregnant woman going to a funeral, to a cemetery. Now, Kriya, the rending of the garments. There are many examples from Tanakh of individuals who tear garments in moments of tragedy. Interestingly, most of these, or maybe all these situations, are a natural tragic death. So there are many examples. One of the most notable ones, but not the only one, is when Yaakov Avinu hears about what he believes to be the death of his son Yosef. The Torah says, "Vayikasim Yosef," he tears his garments. There are many such examples. The source, the actual source for the obligation of kriya in all situations, it's not only in situations of tragedy, but whenever a person experiences death, is, as the Torah tells us, we just read not all that long ago, we had Yom Tov in between, Parsha Shmini, where the Torah describes the death, the tragic death of Nadav and Avihu. So the Torah tells us that Aaron, Eleazar, and Itamar were told that they should not tear their clothing because of their unique status as Kohanim serving the Avodah. But from there, Chazal learned that were it not for that, really that is the proper protocol. The proper thing for people to do in situations where they have lost a relative is to tear kriya. Why do we tear kriya? So number one, it arouses one to emotional pain and reminds them of the loss. I just couldn't pass this up. I found online, tearing kriya, this was a picture of a chef tearing kriya at the Kotel. And I thought that this was an appropriate picture for here, because one of the reasons why we tear kriya is because the process of kriya itself can arouse a person to the state of emotional pain that he should feel. In other words, unfortunately, not everybody is always heartbroken at such a time, and therefore kriya is something that could sort of bring that about. On the other hand, sort of on the other extreme, kriya is also explained as something which could distract a person from his loss if a person is overwhelmingly heartbroken. And finally, it represents the loss of the body, which is sort of a clothing of the soul. This is a point that I mentioned from time to time before tearing kriya with people and explaining to them that just like the clothing that you're about to tear are separate from you, It's not you, it's just something that is on top of your body. So too, the loss of the body is just that. It's the loss of the body, but the soul is eternal, and it continues to live. This is some of the ideas behind why we tear Kriya. Now, from the letter of law, Kriya is done at the time of death. I think I mentioned this last week. However, the generally accepted practice is to wait until the funeral. So if a person is present at the time of the passing of a loved one, technically, according to the letter of the law, that's where they would tear Kriya. However, if one is asking in advance, again, this is the prevalent custom, not just here in Teaneck, but all throughout Klal Yisrael, we tell this person, wait until later, for several reasons. Number one, later usually is the moment of greatest emotion. That sounds a little strange. After all, you would think the moment of death is at a time where a person feels the greatest shock. The answer is yes, maybe the greatest shock, but often people do not really, really become emotional until later, when they're standing there at the funeral and they see the Aron and people around, and people begin to absorb the loss. So at that moment, people feel it, and therefore we want to sort of capture that moment, that that is the moment of the Kriya. Also, it arouses the other people who are assembled to tears, which is one of the objectives of those who are officiating the Maspidim at Alevaya, are to try to bring other people towards tears, and so therefore witnessing others at times tear Kriya is something that could cause other people to become emotional, which is something that we're trying to elicit. And finally, to ensure it's done properly. It happens more often than I wish, where I go to be Menachem Avil and I see somebody sitting there and just can't help but notice, not that I'm trying to be nosy, that Kriya was done improperly. It's not my business who did it or when it was done, but it's clear. I mean, like everything else, there are laws as to how it should be done, and there's no guarantee that even if someone does it with the assistance of another, that it'll be done properly. But most people are just not proficient, thankfully, in the proper ways to do Kriya. So therefore, it's proper normally to wait until later. It is permissible to change clothing before tearing. There's nothing wrong with that. The person says, well, this is actually a very nice suit. Do I have to tear this one? The answer is no, you don't have to. And along the lines of what I mentioned earlier, people should be thoughtful in a very practical way of what they're going to wear to the funeral. For a parent, we tear the shirt and blouse and the jacket and vest, but not coat. So if the person's wearing something just for warmth, and undergarments are not torn. It's done on the left side for a parent, which exposes the heart, in terms of the anatomy of the body. For other relatives, mi'ikar adin, it's only what's called the beged eldon, which means the outer clothing, but the problem is it's not always clear what that is. There's different opinions as to whether it's the shirt or the jacket or the vest. And so therefore you find that often, not always, but often we don't make such distinctions, and depending on the, you know, in the circumstances, you may find that they'll tear both clothing also, but over here it's done on the right side. So it's only for a parent that the tear is done on the left. And going back to something I mentioned earlier, that's not what I'm talking about right now, if a person tears Kriya upon seeing the Harabayas, the area of the Makam HaMikdash, also one would tear over there on the left side. At this time, the Brach of Dayan Emes is recited, again, usually led by whoever's helping to tear the Kriya, and it's customary to have someone else start the tear. That's not obvious. Sometimes people say, no, I know how to do it. So to tell people, I'm not just helping you over here because I don't think you know how to use the scissors, but it's actually proper to have somebody else start the tear, cut the clothing a little bit, and then actually, at that point, the one who's tearing Kriya should be the one to actually tear. It's supposed to be a vertical kick tear of at least 3.5 inches, which is what's called a tefach, over the heart, and not on a seam. So these are some of the details related to Kriya. In terms of the eulogy, what's called a hesped, it is a great mitzvah and a kindness to the deceased to perform and to recite a proper eulogy. It is especially fitting for a son to eulogize a parent. It is not required, but if anybody in this room has ever been in this situation, you know that if I've been consulted, I'll try to push, but not too hard. I'll tell people, listen, whatever you say, I'm sure it'll be beautiful. If a person absolutely doesn't want to speak, one doesn't have to. But it's fitting, and it's appropriate, and it's an honor for a parent to be eulogized by a child. Brief biographical sketch is appropriate. It doesn't have to be the child who does that, but then someone should be given the information beforehand to just present somewhat of a sketch of the person's life. And of course, the maspid should highlight distinguishing qualities and midos tovos of the individual who has passed away. Try to identify those traits that made this person most unique. This is the goal, the objective of a hesped. According to tradition, this is fascinating. The Beis Din Shel Malach, the heavenly court, the tribunal, considers words of Machpidim, of those who eulogize, very seriously. Thus, the word should be positive, should be substantive and truthful. Interestingly, the Taz in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch says that slight exaggerations are permissible. And the reason why slight exaggerations are permissible doesn't mean you're allowed to slightly lie. It's just we assume that they're true. We don't know everything about everyone. So if you see a guy's a really nice guy, at his funeral you can say he's a really, really nice guy because he was probably a little more nice than you knew. But only slight exaggerations to stand up and to say, you know, this guy, he was, you know, he never missed shul and he finished shot 10 times. Meanwhile, nobody's seen him for 20 years. You're not doing him a big favor. You're not doing him a big favor. I mean, that's the way we have to understand this, that our words at such a time are taken seriously. And forgive me if this should be obvious, and I will say that for the most part of my experience, it is obvious, but you only have to see it once to never forget it. Hespedim should not include words that reflect kalus rosh. There are times, it's okay when sometimes people tell over something at a funeral that makes people laugh. Kalus rosh is not about saying something that makes people smile or laugh, especially if the person had a sense of humor and there was something that they said. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But when you hear about people who spend, and I've heard this, 10, 15, 20 minutes talking about how much this person loves sports, sports and sports and sports and sports and sports, and that's like all people could say, that's very, very inappropriate, then it would be best just to say to Hillam and sit down. I mean, but I'm not joking. I mean, no, it's not a kavod to a person to stand at their funeral and talk about things in life that are just really, really not that important. To mention that the guy, he loves sports, okay, you could stick that in. But that should be the focus of the hesped, that's not appropriate. And finally, I mentioned this, but we're not discussing details right now, but there are days where eulogies are not recited. Days such as Rosh Chodesh, and Chanukah, and Chol HaMoed, and the entire month of Nisan. It's likely that everyone here has experienced this on some level, either in terms of your own personal circumstances, or you've been to a funeral. You may have been to funerals where you've heard the officiating rabbi get up and say, listen, today's a day that one is not permitted to eulogize, and then proceed to deliver a 40-minute eulogy. I've been there as well. I hope you can't say that I'm guilty of that myself, because I know that when I'm sitting in the pews, it bothers me very, very much. On the other hand, it's unusual, but very, very remarkable, and I would say inspiring. And I've seen this, I think, at least twice, to go to a Breuer's funeral. I'm going to single them out in this regard. In the month of Nisan, or such a similar day, where the funeral, let's say, starts at 3 o'clock, and they get up and they say Tehillim, and say Hespedim are not permitted today, and the funeral literally ends at 3:01. And everybody gathers in the room. You can have 10, 20, 100, 200 people there. The funeral takes a minute. And I have to say, you know, personally, I find that very inspiring. Sometimes people feel let down, and they feel, yeah, but my parents, my brother, my sister, whatever, deserves more. And the answer is, first of all, it's not our place to say who deserves what. There are times, first of all, Shiva is a great opportunity for people to speak, and then in a more public forum, you could create opportunities later. But to yield to the halacha in such a situation, first of all, we cannot possibly quantify what kavod that is for the mace. And at the same time, there's a time to speak, eis l'daber, v'yesh l'shtok. There is a middle of the way approach, which is commonly practiced, and that is something in the middle, and that is that the hespedim are toned down in terms of their length. Those who are masped are instructed not to speak in a way that will make others cry. And usually in these situations, the officiating rabbi will say, let's say, a Dvar Torah or something like that. And the Hameven Yavin, if you're listening carefully, you'll understand that this really relates to the mace. There's nothing inappropriate about that. There's nothing wrong with that. And that's often what we see. But just to be aware that this is not a cop-out, and if it should ever happen in any way, again, to you, that you find yourself in a situation where you feel that the Nevuch, this guy was such a wonderful guy, and now he's lost out on the opportunity to have a spade, and we really shouldn't look at it that way. We should really try to appreciate the context of what's happening now, that this is a happy time for the Jewish people, and this really speaks about the way we work as a people, that individuals are part of a tzibur when they're alive, and even after they're passing. Yes?
Number two over there, taking for a son to eulogize a parent, does that mean as opposed to a daughter?
No, it doesn't mean as opposed to. In the Sfarim that I use, it says a son as opposed to a daughter. It doesn't say as opposed to a daughter, it says a son. the reality is that until very recently in history, it was unheard of to have women speak in public, including at funerals. There are certain communities today which would not allow a woman to speak at a funeral. As you know, because you've been to funerals that I've officiated at, I would allow a woman to speak at a funeral, and I personally don't think that's objectionable. That's not the kind of thing that we would say, no, that's not something that could be done. But over here, just to, you know, just to sort of preserve the integrity of our Masorah, the tradition, that the way it is brought down that is especially fitting for a son. Although, again, customarily today, depending on your community, you may find that it is more common to find women who will speak at the funeral of a parent. In terms of the funeral itself, now this, I know I'm going to get some responses from this statement I'm about to make. Before the kavura, there should be no formal receiving of menachemim, nor should words of nechama be extended. Meaning, you see that picture over there? It's the best I could find off the internet. That's what the room should look like beforehand. You see? There's nobody there. And it's not me, it's a mission of Avos, which tells us, Rav Shimon Elazar says, Al tenachameinu b'shasha meisu muta lefanef. Now I know that this is not common practice. Common practice is everybody gathers in the room and they have Elam stand there and we all say, I'm so sorry, you're such a wonderful person. And I get caught up in it myself sometimes. Although, if you look closely, you'll see next time. I try not to. I really just try to stand off to the corner and be helpful if I can, and for the most part, not participate. It's obviously an awkward situation where this is what people want and this is what they expect and this is what everybody's used to. But the concept of having this welcoming reception room is not a Jewish concept. It is not part of our Masorah, and to the contrary, I try, and it's difficult sometimes when helping somebody before the kavura deal with their loss to say, and I'll usually make some sort of disclaimer, like it's premature at this time to be able to issue words of nechama. Or, and then maybe it's like Nishabat Gret. But I'm sorry, you know. But in other words, you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that Chazal told us there's a time for everything, and to go ahead and to just greet people in a room. This is now, again, I know that it's common in not just in this community, in many communities, and I'm not saying it's asur behechleit and b'shumofan. We should never find ourselves in this situation. We should be aware of it. We should know that there are communities that actually have tried to curb it, and maybe by just getting the word out, so. We'll be able slowly but surely to bring people back to the more authentic tradition. Now, this is very important. Mourners and guests should not extend formal greetings to each other, Levaya. You're not going to go over to a mourner and say, give them a big Shalom Aleichem, but you do sometimes find other people who do that. I'm sometimes on the receiving end, it's very uncomfortable. Frankly, I've sometimes had Rabbanim who come over to me and say, oh, Shalom Aleichem, and it's like a Tisha B'Av. You're not supposed to make a person feel bad. Yeah, okay, say hello back. But really, she'elah shalom, not only for the mourners, for all the guests, is not appropriate to levaya, and mourners and our guests should not stand around and schmooze at levaya, especially inappropriate to have conversations in the room with the mace. What really should happen at levaya, if you take Gutterman's as an example, the aveilim should be in a room with a very, very small group of people, and everybody should come in, go straight into the chapel, and say tehillim. That's what really should happen. It's not what happens. What happens is, everybody goes in, and speaks to the mourners, and then you have several people sitting in the chapel. Most often, they're just schmoozing. Now, again, there are exceptions. If it's an extraordinary tragedy, and everybody in the community is just completely lost for words, you'll see that naturally on everybody's face in such a situation. But if it's not that type of levaya, if it's a type of levaya where a person, Baruch Hashem, had a very, very long life, and if the passing was not unexpected, and even the avelim themselves are feeling a sense of relief, and that, so if that type of levaya. So you sometimes find that people sit there and schmooze a little before, but we have to try to remind ourselves that we're in the presence of a mace, and we should try to conduct ourselves with kovod rosh throughout. If one will not be escorting the mace to the cemetery, you should try to be malava the aron at least 4 amos. A levaya means to escort. That's what it means. It doesn't mean funeral in the most literal sense. It means to escort somebody. That's the way we escort the mace. Usually what happens is people carry the aron, and they put it in the hearse, and it starts moving. We follow it into the street a little bit. The aron should be carried and handled exclusively by Jews. Mourners themselves should not participate in the handling of an aron. Occasionally, there may be extenuating circumstances whereby the officiating rabbi determines that assistance from the cemetery employees is necessary to guarantee a safe and proper burial. This decision should be respected, and it should be understood that when deemed appropriate, the delegation of these tasks to the cemetery employees is considered a demonstration of kavod hames. If this sounds defensive, it is, because I've been on the other end when people have second guessed my judgment and thought that we can handle it. And at the end of the day, if a family asks you to officiate at the levaya of their loved one, it's your responsibility to make sure that things are done properly. I understand and appreciate that it is definitely proper, l'chatchila, ideally, Jews and only Jews should carry the aron. That's the greatest sign of kavod ames. However, in a situation where it's very tight and it's raining for a week or two beforehand and the ground is very slippery and most people there have never done this before and people are very old and they're not strong, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. And I've seen it once. Thankfully, I was not officiating, but very selfishly, thankfully. I mean, but it's an awful thing to have to see when the oven gets dropped, and it's simply not worth it. So you have to be, you have to be careful and responsible in this situation. And if you're ever to Levaya, where you see that decision is made, we're now going to not just allow, but we're going to ask the cemetery personnel to help us out. That's a decision that should be respected. At the cemetery, as the oven is being carried to the grave, traditionally, Perek Tzadi Aleph of Tehillim, Yosheb says the Olin is recited. We have the seven mamados, the seven stops, which the Medrash tells us is based on the fact that in the very beginning of Koheles, it says, Havel Avelim, Omer Koheles, Havel Avelim, Akol Hevel, the reference to seven Havolim, seven Danis, an idea of hesitating as we bring the person to their final resting place. But that's the idea of seven mamados. We try to avoid walking on other graves if possible. Again, here as well, I don't mind, but there are often times where people are telling me, don't stand there. I know where I'm standing, but there's only one place where you could stand when you're lowering a person into the grave. So all things being equal, we don't stand on seven tops of someone else's grave. But in a tight spot, sometimes you have to walk on tops of someone else's grave, and that's okay. That's okay in that situation. Assembled should participate in the burial. That's part of the mitzvah. It's not just to come, but it's to participate if one can. A person should try to assist in the process. There's a tradition we have not to pass the shovel directly to another person. This is based on the pasuk in Koheleth, Ein shilton b'yom ha-maves, which literally means that on the day of death, on the day of passing, there's no shilton, there's no dominance. We feel completely subordinate to the forces that are beyond our control. But almost b'derech olitza, Chazal have understood, in shilton b'yom ha-maves, we're not sholit, we don't hold on to anything b'yom ha-maves, so we don't hold on to the shovel. That's the idea. Also, it's a little more of a refined way for handling the situation like that. When you're digging for a treasure, you pass the shovel. In this situation, we show a certain degree of reluctance. We're not eager, we're not anxious, even though we're doing a mitzvah, it's not that type of mitzvah, so therefore we don't pass the shovel one to another. For the same reason, a similar reason, there's a tradition that the first three shovels of dirt you do with the back of the shovel. We show that this is not a regular type of shoveling. We're not digging for the purpose of planting. And we also show that this is not permanent. So we believe in Pachiyas HaMesim, and that's part of the message that's conveyed by shoveling in sort of a backhanded way, literally, at least initially. L'chadchilo, which means ideally, the entire grave should be filled by Jews, with the assembled remaining present. As I mentioned beforehand, sometimes that's possible, sometimes that's not. I noticed in Rabbi Lamb's book, it's a classic, it's written, I don't know, probably 30, 40 years ago, the Jewish way in death and mourning. So Rabbi Lamb speaks very, very harshly. I didn't put it in here because it really doesn't speak so much to our community about the practice that I guess was very common years ago and maybe still is in other segments of the Jewish community, to basically put in a little dirt and walk away and let the caretakers, finish it. But it's not, and we do that maybe to shorter shield. Actually, I think I did put it in here. I did. I'm sorry. I'm remembering now. I thought I put it in because I think this was powerful and does speak to us psychologically. Well, that was the context for this. But he says psychologically, the heart-rending thought of earth on the casket is enormously beneficial. In proclaiming finality, it helps the mourner overcome the illusion that his relative still lives. It answers his disbelief that death has indeed claimed its victim. It quiets his lingering doubts that this may only be a bad dream. The earth-filling process dispels such illusions and starts the mourner on the way to recovery and reconciliation. To attempt to spare him this unpleasantness merely retards the psychological healing process. Very profound words. We should not try to shield people from the very unpleasant sound of, like you said, the thud of the earth hitting the casket. That is part of the process. It is not one that is supposed to be intentionally painful to experience. But that is part of the experience. And it shouldn't, people, especially the mourners, should not be shielded of that. I remember one of the, it may have actually been the first Levaya that ever officiated here at the shul. I remember it was a very small crowd, and it was not an observing crowd for the most part. It was here in Saddlebrook. I'll never forget, it was a beautiful day, right before Sukkot, and there were just a couple people over there who were shoveling, and nobody was helping. And I saw, you know, people had no idea what we were doing. They were not, they had never seen us before. They were like, you know, Rabbi, we can stop now. You know, you put a few shovels in, we can leave. And, looking back, I'm actually impressed with myself because I was really, really rookie at that point, and I'm surprised that I had the guts to speak up. But I remember what I said, and I said, listen, folks, this person here, you know, lived, I remember, 70, 80, 90 years. She did a lot for us. You know, means a lot to us, you know, and would have gone the extra mile for us. How many times this person slept this way? This is the last thing that we could do for this person. You know, why would we walk away and just delegate this to people who are just, you know, here, you know, to fulfill a job when we're here to do something that's very holy? And I guess it was enough. People joined and helped, and we filled in the whole grave. And why do I remember that? I don't remember that after this. This is why I remember it, because afterwards, numerous people came over to me and said it was the most amazing thing that they had ever done, experienced in their life. And my heart was broken for these people, that they had clearly been to many funerals before, Jewish funerals, and they'd never seen that. And they felt like they were denied in the past an experience that they found to be truly cathartic. So, yeah, sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cold. Sometimes it's brutally hot, brutally cold. And yes, like I said before, there are times where you just got to know when to call it quits. You don't want it, you forgive me, you don't want anybody dying at a funeral. So if you can't do it, you can't do it. So at the very least, if we cover the aron, okay, so we've done the bare minimum. But we should try to do more. The idea of making a tsuras hakever, which we try to do, of sort of bringing the dirt above the ground towards the center, is to just make sure that people know that there's a grave there. Practically speaking, today, see people buried in cemeteries. The cemetery knows where people are buried. They're not going to forget. They're not going to accidentally. The concern is that if it's not as organized, then someone may dig it up to bury someone else there, and lo and behold, it turns out that they're disturbing another kever. So therefore, we make sure that it should be very clear that someone is buried here, and that's the idea of making the suicide kever. At the conclusion, some actually do this before, but in our community we do it at the conclusion of the burial. We do what's called the Tzidik Adin, which is recited by the Avelim together with others. Not everybody always has a copy. I've seen, and this is a nice thing, sometimes rabbis bring lots of sheets for everybody to read from, because really the Tzidik Adin should be recited by other people together. The Tzidik Adin has three major themes. Number one, that death is ordained by God, and his decrees are justified. In fact, the first words, Hatsur Tamim Palo Kichod Rachav Mishpat, El Munav Ein Novel Tzadik Yashar Hu, means that God is just and his ways are just, and it's a way of accepting the concept that the Dayan Emes has made this choice. We pray for mercy and compassion for the survivors. And finally, we say that God is the one who gives and God is the one who takes, Hashem Nasan Vashem Lakach, and we thank him for the time that he's given to us. We try through the Tzidik Adin to express our appreciation for the time that we've been given on this earth. There's something called the Kaddish HaGadol, also known as the Kaddish HaSchadata, which is special burial Kaddish. This is only recited at the time of burial, and also it's recited, interestingly, at the time when a person makes a Siyum, a Masechta, let's say. It is known as burial Kaddish. It's a unique Kaddish, and it touches upon the following major themes, all in that first paragraph. God will create the world anew. There will be Tchiyat HaMesim. There is a future for the dead. Yerushalayim will be built. The Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt. So there's a lot contained within this, and obviously it's a very uplifting and optimistic prayer, as Kaddish in general is, but this is a little more of a more general one, which is unique to the occasion. Omitted on days when there is no Tachanun.
Excuse me, what's omitted on days?
This type of Kaddish, this special Kaddish, is not said on days where there's some, you know, it's somewhat of a festive day. So on a day like that, we would just say the regular mortar's Kaddish, which is the shorter version, which does not contain all of these unique messages, which are unique to a burial. Of course, this requires a minyan. A burial does not require a minyan. It's nice when you have, not all that long ago, there was an announcement on TNX Shuls, which was forwarded to me. I know that because I don't get TNX Shuls, but someone forwarded to me. And it says, there's a mace mitzvah situation. You need a minyan at a cemetery. So, I think it was great to post that. And I would encourage people to take advantage of that opportunity. But in the most technical sense, that's not a meis mitzvah. A meis mitzvah is where there's nobody to arrange for the burial. That's a very, very serious situation, which requires everyone's dropping whatever you're doing, as Chazal tell us, even a Kohen Gadol, stop what you're doing in order to deal with a meis mitzvah. That's a very, very pressing issue. To say that there'll be a burial without a minyan, that's sad and that's unfortunate. We should try, as we can as a community, make sure that doesn't happen too often, but all it really means is that there's not going to be a kaddish at the end, but everything else that is said and done at a funeral is done with or without a minyan. Concluding rituals, including asking the mechila from the deceased. You may mention last week what we said that this is done at the time, actually before and after the passing, but this is done particularly at this point where there have been many things that have happened since in terms of the attempt to properly bring a person to a quick burial and the tahara and the shmira and everything that was done. We want to make sure that we treated the person with respect and we ask mechila if we have not. Availing changed shoes at this time is the availing period officially commences. There are two shuros, two lines of people that are made whereby the assembled express their first form of words of lechama, and note the shift of attention from the nifta to the mourners, the transition from anidas tavelis, which, if you'll bear several minutes with me after, I'll read one more quote from the Soloveitchik, who captures this so beautifully. It is customary to remove some grass and throw it over the shoulder, and to say zachor ki afar anachnu, that we remember at this time, which is a very profound custom, because we remind ourselves as we're leaving the cemetery. It's uncomfortable being in a cemetery, particularly for a funeral. As we mentioned last week, death reminds us of our own mortality and our own unpreparedness. We all just want to get out of there as soon as possible, not because we need to be somewhere else, because it's not a comfortable place to be. It's really a very, very deep and profound custom to take some grass and to throw it over one's shoulder and to remind oneself that that we are all afar. We are all dust that one day will return to the earth. And to take something, hachayitin alibo, to take something from the funeral with us. It is improper to visit another kever after a funeral. So if a person says, well, once I'm here anyway, I might as well spend a little time at this kever and that kever, that's not proper after a funeral. And of course, we wash hands upon leaving the cemetery three times b'seirugin, which is like we do in the morning, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, as different than when we wash our hands before we eat. Here as well, we don't pass the utensil to another. We don't dry our hands. These are all customs. Most of these are all really rituals. These are not actual laws, with the exception of an avil changing of shoes. I'd like to conclude with one more quote from Rav Soloveitchik. If you want to daven Mariv, you're excused, because it's now 9:28 and a half. If you're not rushing to daven Mariv, just stay to hear this very, very, very profound statement from the Rav. And if you missed the quote, you can. Go back and listen online, because it's just absolutely incredible, absolutely amazing. Remember, the Rav beforehand spoke about what anidos is. At this point, right where we are right now, the shift from anidos havelos, says the Rav, the dialectical halacha, which is masterfully employed both the thesis and the antithesis in her treatment of antinomies, makes an about face. The halacha is firmly convinced the man is free, and that he is master not only of his deeds, but of his emotions as well. The halacha holds the view that man's mastery of his emotional life is unqualified, and that he is capable of changing thought patterns, emotional structures, and experiential motifs within an infinitesimal period of time. Man, the halacha maintains, does not have to wait patiently for one mood to pass, and for another to emerge gradually. He disengages himself quickly and actively, and in a wink replaces a disjunctive frame of mind with a cathartic, redemptive one. Hence, the halacha, which showed so much tolerance for the mourner during the stage of aninos and let him float with the tide of black despair, now, forcefully and with a shift of emphasis, commands that, with internment, the first phase of grief comes abruptly to a close, and a second phase, that of avelos, begins. With the commencement of avelos, the halacha commands the mourner to undertake a heroic task, to start picking up the debris of his own shattered personality, and to reestablish himself as man, restoring lost glory, dignity, and uniqueness. Instead of repeating to himself time and again that no one has, that man has no preeminence over the beast and that all is vanity, he is suddenly told by the halacha to be mindful of the antithesis. Thou hast chosen man at the very inception, and thou hast recognized him as worthy of standing before thee from our davening and Yom Kippur. Yes, the halacha tells man death is indeed sometimes ugly and frightening, something grisly and monstrous. Yes, death is trailing behind every man, trying to defeat him, his ambitions and aspirations. All that is true. Nevertheless, the halacha adds, death must not confuse man. The latter must not plunge into total darkness because of death. On the contrary, the halacha asserts death gives man the opportunity to display greatness, to act heroically, to build, even though that he knows that he will not live to enjoy the sight of the magnificent edifice in his construction he is engaged, to plant, even though he does not expect to eat the food, to explore, to develop, to enrich, not himself, but coming generations. Death teaches man to transcend his physical self and to identify with the timeless covenantal community. Death, the halacha warns the mourner, not only does not free man from his commitment, but on the contrary, enhances his role as a historic being and sensitizes his moral consciousness. The day is short, the workload is heavy, the master is strict and demanding, as it says in Avos, and the commitment is therefore great. Last quote. Before burial, in the stage of Aninos, man mourned in total darkness and confusion, and his grief expressed itself as an act of resignation from his greatness and chosenness. After burial, in stage two, man mourns in an enlightened mood, and his grief asserts itself in the awareness of human greatness and human election. The ceremonial turning point at which Aninos is transformed into Avelos, spirit into intelligent sadness, and self-negation to self-affirmation, is found in the recital of the Kaddish of the Grave. Forgive me, this is the last one, for real. The Kaddish marks the beginning of a new phase of courageous and heroic mourning to which the message of salvation is addressed. What is the relationship between the proclamation of the solemn doxology and burial? Through the Kaddish, we hurl defiance at death and its fiendish conspiracy against man. When a mortar recites, Yiskadal v'yiskadash shemei rabah, he declares, no matter how powerful death is, notwithstanding the ugly end of man, however terrifying the grave is, however nonsensical and absurd everything appears, no matter how black one's despair is and how nauseating an affair life is, we declare and profess publicly and solemnly that we are not giving up, that we are not surrendering, that we will carry on the work of our ancestors as though nothing has happened, that we will not be satisfied with less than the full realization of the ultimate goal, the establishment of God's kingdom, the resurrection of the dead, and eternal life for man. It's a very, very beautiful, profound quote from the Rav, in which he really captures, I hope, as you were able to appreciate tonight, the bookends of what we presented tonight. That stage of Aninos, which is when man is initially plunged into the dark, despair-ridden experience of death, but slowly, through a very, hopefully, a very quick process, emerges ready to assume perhaps a greater challenge, and that is to move forward, to begin the more cathartic, redemptive process of Avelos, and try to reconcile the loss that one has experienced with the greater obligation that a person has to preserve the legacies of those who have preceded and to move forward. So thank you very much. That concludes our shiur for this evening. Next week we will conclude with perspectives on Avelos in Halach and Hashkaf. I hope next week we'll be able to talk about the concept of Shiva and Shloshim and Yud Beis Chodesh for one who mourns for parents. So thank you again. Hope to see you then.